I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Many Christian fundamentalists have never accepted homosexuality. Instead, they've set up boot camps and ministries across America to make gays straight, or at least not gay. They've called it conversion therapy and pushed it hard. But when a 16-year-old blogger from Tennessee was signed up for conversion boot camp by his parents and wrote that he feared for his sanity and his life, gay activists and mental health workers cried foul. Conversion therapy, they charge, is at best quackery and at worst dangerous. Tonight we'll hear from the head of a ministry that offers programs for people to overcome homosexuality. We'll hear from a 22-year-old woman who feels she has successfully suppressed her homosexuality, as well as from a young man who says the therapy did not work for him. And we'll hear from a psychiatric therapist. This hour on Point, the controversy over so-called conversion therapy for gays. We begin tonight with the story of a 16-year-old gay blogger and the debate his postings sparked. Alex Williams is a reporter for the New York Times and has been following the story. He joins me now. Alex, thanks for being with us tonight.
Pleasure to be here.
So tell us the story of the 16-year-old named Zach and how it came to light.
Well, the story is an interesting one because this is a matter that probably would have been just written in a diary and tucked away someplace a few short years ago, but now, thanks to the miracles of online communication, Zach had basically been told by his parents that he was going to be put in this camp within weeks or so of, or perhaps within days of coming out to them, and he got online and started complaining about it to basically in a blog that was read by his friends, and word quickly got out to some local gay activists in Memphis, and they thought it was outrageous. They saw it as basically brainwashing, and so they decided to organize and picket the group, and so they showed up a few days later at Love in Action headquarters.
We'll dig into all of that. These days, young people are very candid very often in blogs, as if they turned a personal diary inside out. Tell us about Love in Action and its operations in Memphis.
Well, Love in Action is becoming one of the most well-known ex-gay ministries, and they are the first one to officially target teenagers, which is one of the reasons this story has really taken off. They've been around for several years. They were spun off from a California group in the early 90s. The group actually started in the early 70s with the rise of the gay rights movement. But they have recently two and a half years ago, they started a program called Refuge, which was specifically for teenagers. And of course, the big controversy here is that unlike a lot of adults who choose to go into these programs, because many times they've been raised in fundamentalist Christian households, mm-hmm. they themselves struggle with their own sexuality and how to reconcile that with Christianity. But this was a case where with teenagers, the parents check you in. And in the case of Zach, as you read in his blogs, he really didn't seem to have any interest in changing himself or certainly going into the camp. And so it became sort of a message-in-the-bottle sort of story.
He wrote, "If I do come out straight, I'll be so mentally unstable and depressed, it won't matter." A couple of terms I want to understand a little better here. First, you mentioned ex-gay ministry, and of course there's this phrase conversion therapy. What do each of these refer to exactly?
Well, these are all very sort of gray terms. Love in Action is very much, they very much keep on message. They claim not to be reparative therapy. They claim not to be conversion therapy. They resist these terms because, in their view, they're not trying to actually turn you into heterosexuals, but just basically overcome gay impulses. It's very much like an Alcoholics Anonymous, where the idea is that you never necessarily don't feel the twinge of temptation when you see the bottle, but you just don't partake in the behavior, and that's very much what they say. And of course, Reverend John Smith, who's the head of Love in Action, he was gay up until 16 years ago, he says, and then through going through programs like this, he's been straight ever since, he says. But even though he has turned straight, it's not necessarily the goal, but the goal is simply to overcome and control and suppress gay impulses.
We're going to hear from Reverend Smith in a moment, but before we do, tell us what we know about how the story has played out with Zach, last name unknown, and good for him. Did he go to the refuge? What did he say on his way in? Do we know what happened there?
Well, they're very confidential about it. He did go in. He started off with the 2-week program, which is the way most people start. But I guess many kids. There have been 24 so far youths who have gone through the program. Many of them have stayed on for the additional 6 weeks. He's due to come out perhaps today. It was never quite confirmed to me because being a 12-step-ish sort of program, they don't talk about their members. And so I think Reverend Smith, as he might tell you, was in the awkward position of not really being able to talk about this, mm-hmm. even though it became national news.
No, this
but,
is just
he
this
did
is just
go in, mm-hmm. and since he's been in, he's had no contact with the outside world because even though adults that go into the program actually live in residential homes with other Love in Action members, and so it's really a 24-hour therapy process, whereas teenagers actually go during working days, 5 days a week, but then spend the rest of the time with their parents and are not supposed to see other friends that are not approved by the program and that sort of thing.
Zach posted before he went in, he wrote, "I can't take this. No one can. I'm not a suicidal person. I think it's stupid, really, but I can't help it. No, I'm not going to commit suicide. All I can think about is killing my mother and myself. It's so horrible." I mean, teenagers go through a lot of angst, but that's a fairly pinning the meter kind there.
Oh, yeah. It'll be very interesting to see how he comes out of it. That's the million-dollar question here, I suppose. But, one of the reasons that the activists were so outraged is because they're worried that any teenager struggles with his sexuality, and it's a matter of it's very difficult to come up with your own identity when you're 16 years old, and then to actually have to take a fundamental part of it and change it. That's what they think is the riskiest thing.
What's known about what goes on at Refuge, the program there? What's it entail?
Well, it entails a number of things. There's a lot of scriptural study. There are actual chores, just sort of keeping the place
tended. Keeping it going.
Exactly. And there are a lot of group meetings where people stand up and give their testimonials, basically, sort of updates as to where they stand with the struggle. I feel this, I feel that. They're supposed to keep diaries, which recount their struggle with their sexual orientation over the years, or at least their sexual orientation.
Mm. And you're right, they keep a moral inventory of all their homosexual impulses and encounters over time. No touching other than handshakes, no campy talk or behavior allowed. Really trying to put kids on the straight and narrow.
No secular music, no Calvin Klein clothing, that sort of thing. Yes, it's very much... It's very much trying to reinforce a certain sort of groupthink, which is, I think they would say it's love and support. Other people would say it's, perhaps mind control. But that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to create an environment in which you're free from temptation and therefore don't, quote unquote, backslide.
Alex, stand by if you would. I want to welcome into our conversation from Memphis, Tennessee, Reverend John Smith. He's executive director of Love in Action, an evangelical organization that offers programs, it says, helps its clients overcome their homosexuality. Reverend Smith, thanks for being with us tonight.
It's great to be with you, Tom.
So tell us about your program. First of all, what's the goal? What's the purpose?
Well, one of our goals is to offer teens options regarding their sexuality. We find that society offers about one option, and that is to remain involved in homosexuality and to pursue that. So our goal is to offer teens other options that we don't believe society is offering them.
You've seen quite a lot of controversy since young Zach's or the web postings came out. What do you make of the angry response you've had from people who are saying this is brainwashing, this is cruel to a young person?
It certainly has been a lively 8 weeks for us.
Yeah, I bet.
We find that, actually hundreds of people are looking for help, and I think that this is just a small tapping into society's real quest for this. I think there are a lot of teens that would ask for help if they could, and they're really forgotten by society because there is only one message, and that is you have to accept your homosexuality and therefore pursue it. But we recognize that there are hundreds of teens that would rather not, and we just offer that option. I think we need to celebrate the fact that there are options and that people don't have to follow just one way of thinking.
And how do you guide teens away from homosexuality? What's the treatment like?
One of the main things we do is we help them to think. We recognize that actually a study just came out this week in our local newspaper that people that are under 20 years old have a difficult time making decisions that are based on reason. And so they enter into dangerous behaviors in their sexuality, their relationship practices, drug and alcohol abuses. So it's actually proven that kids under 20 years old really do need the guidance of their parents and others that can help them and support them as they make decisions that could be life-changing.
But
we offer that kind of support and encouragement.
Do you reject the notion that these young people are innately homosexual, innately gay?
I reject the notion that they're born gay. I don't reject the notion that they may have long-standing struggles with homosexuality. So I would say that's true. I think that they do have an inner desire or inner attractions that are for same-sex relationships, but we do hold very tightly to the fact that indiscriminate sexuality and sexual promiscuity and sexual practices in teenage years could end up being quite detrimental.
Alex Williams, we just got you for another minute here. There's been some formal inquiry into Refuge since this whole controversy broke. Has it come to anything? Have Tennessee authorities given it the green light?
Well, Reverend Smid's probably more up to date on that than I am, but the last I reported, they were looking into it to make sure that they stayed within the bounds of being a spiritual center and not a any sort of treatment center for drug or alcohol or any of the sort of related behaviors that they believe often come with homosexuality. So I don't know what the very latest ruling is. Last I heard from the state of Tennessee was that they were looking into it, and Reverend Smid was telling me that they are doing everything to comply.
We are going to hear in a moment from a couple of young people who have struggled with their homosexuality with different results. Alex Williams of the New York Times, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And Reverend John Smid, Executive Director of Love in Action. Please stick with us. We want to learn more. We're talking tonight about the controversy over so-called conversion therapy for gays. Fundamentalist Christians are pushing it. Many others oppose it. What do you think? Can homosexuality be changed by counseling, by sitting with the Bible? Should it be changed? And how would you characterize conversion therapy? Is it moral? Is it merciful? Is it misguided or cruel? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the controversy over so-called conversion therapy for gays. Fundamentalist Christians are pushing it. There's a lot of opposition as well. What do you think? You can join us tonight. Are Christianity and homosexuality incompatible? Can a gay person be counseled, be reprogrammed, be scared straight? Is it loving or cruel to try? And gay listeners, have you tried to become ex-gay by choice or by compulsion? And did it work? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been hearing tonight from Reverend John Smith, joining us tonight from Memphis. He's Executive Director of Love in Action, and his group has been at the huge of a minor, at least, firestorm after a 16-year-old from Tennessee posted his fears after his parents signed him up for the Refuge, where young people are encouraged to find an alternative path to homosexuality. I want to hear tonight as well from a couple of people who have been down this road with different results. We're joined now from Miami, Florida, by Leah Dariel. She's a 22-year-old 2004 graduate of Cornell University. She's an engineer who says she has overcome her lesbian feelings. Leah, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
And we're joined from Dallas, Texas, by Brandon Tidwell. He's a former client of Love in Action, John Smith's group, and belongs now to the Methodist Church. He's 29 years old and is not so sure that it worked for him. Brandon, thanks very much for joining us.
Glad to join you.
Leah, first to you. Tell us about your experience. Tell us why you signed up for a support group to work on your sexuality and how it worked out.
Well, the reason that I initially joined was just because I, in my reading of the Bible, everything that I had read, all the references that were in there regarding homosexuality condemned it. And that's not to say that if you're gay, God hates you, but it is to say that just like lying or cheating or any other thing like that, God would like to see that change. So that's why I initially joined the group, and the results have been fantastic. I've found a safe place where I can go and share and be honest with other people and with myself about what I go through.
Lee, were you openly, actively a lesbian before you began attending the support group?
Openly, somewhat, actively, yes.
And now?
Well, I'm still careful about who I share with, because some people will take that information and twist it, and some people are safe people to talk to that about.
Right. It's always dangerous. So openness you're careful about, but what about your sense of yourself and your sexuality? Are you still lesbian? Are you still homosexual? Or do you believe you're now something else? Are you straight?
Well, the feelings come back from time to time. But I guess I would have to draw a parallel to laziness at work or something like that. There's always a temptation there. But it's what you do with it that matters. So I found that as I have learned what to do with the temptations as they come, I have been able to check that really well.
You've said, I've read, that the opposite of homosexuality for you, Leah, the opposite of homosexuality is holiness, not necessarily heterosexuality, but holiness.
Yes, that's correct. It would be the same thing as adultery or something like that, because the point is not to change homosexual lust into heterosexual lust. It's still lust. There's no distinction there. The point is to...
But heterosexuality is not condemned in the Bible.
No, but lust is.
So are you asexual at this point?
Not really, because I have been attracted to guys.
Mm-hmm. Wow, it's a complicated path, and we hear your commitment to being on it. Brandon Tidwell, what about your experience? A bit different, I think. Tell us your story.
Well, I enrolled in Love in Action in 2002 myself. And,
this is John Smith's program in Memphis.
Yes, mm-hmm. They did the three-month program there. And stayed somewhat connected with the ministry, but in 2003, I went on a real search to see if I could reconcile my identity as a gay man and my faith. And I found absolute freedom in that, in a congregation that embraced me and that helped me to see that a lot of people were taking a very narrow view of Scripture and continuing to label homosexual activity as a sin, when actually I began to see a lot of models of homosexual relationships that were just like any heterosexual relationship I had seen in churches, but they were honoring God in that, and I began to understand that I could honor God with my life and still be a gay man.
So you did not become ex-gay or straight. Rather, you reconciled your homosexuality to your Christianity.
Absolutely. And I would agree with Leah that there's never a message, I think, in some regards from Love and Action to say that they're trying to turn you straight. I think that is true. But the challenge is that they're buying into a message from the church that there is only one way, that there is, you have to reject homosexuality, when that takes on a very narrow view of God, a very narrow view of Scripture. There are a lot of homosexuals who can honor God and honor their faith and honor their following of Christ and still be gay.
Reverend Smith, after the Zach postings came out, you had folks outside the refuge, you know, protesting, carrying signs, saying this is child abuse and Jesus is no excuse for hate. Brandon says he's managed to reconcile his sexuality and his Christianity. What do you say to that?
Well, I think personally my own conviction is that there's not one positive reflection of homosexuality in Scripture. And so I believe that in a scriptural perspective, a biblical perspective, that if a person is struggling with their sexuality with regards to temptations to adultery or fornication or homosexual behavior, it's really all in the same category, that I believe there's only one place for sexuality, and that's in for a sexual activity is in a heterosexual marriage. And otherwise, then singleness or sobriety with your sexuality is the other option. And the scriptures are very clear that singleness is a very supported thing. It's a very positive thing. And I think part of the problem is that as a church, we don't look at singleness as being very positive. And so a lot of people feel a lot of pressure to either be married or have a relationship in homosexuality. And
when you say singleness, you mean just kind of not being sexually active?
Yeah, well, yes, sexual sobriety, not being active sexually. And I think the argument here is not really about whether a person's asexual or homosexual or heterosexual, or those are all behaviorally defined. Those are certainly can be internal attractions, but I just want to say change is absolutely possible when a person is motivated to do so, and we offer the option to find the courage to ask for that change.
What portion of the people who come through your program come out the other side of a couple of years later saying, I'm no longer gay, or I'm gay, but I'm not, but I'm sexually abstinent, I guess.
I think what we have to look at here is certainly people, when they come to Love in Action, we are a place on the road of life, and the people that come there, they have an opportunity to get in touch with some things, to deal with some life weights and burdens, and when they're through with Love in Action, it's not necessarily my goal to have any kind of governance over their life after they leave. That people are always left with options and choices about their life, and change is possible. You know, it is possible to walk away from this, and you know, I think we have to recognize that there's a reality to my story, and there's a reality to many stories. I've been sexually moral and faithful to my wife for 16 years.
Though you were a self-identified homosexual 17 years ago.
It was longer than that. I left homosexuality 20 years ago.
20 years ago, excuse me. Mm-hmm.
And today, I don't really, to label me is to really deny me my identity. Mm-hmm. I don't like the labels of homosexual or heterosexual. I don't think those really help us at all. I'm a man of God, and I choose to live my life with my wife as in a faithful marriage. I mean, that's who I am today.
Brandon Tidwell, do you today hear John Smith's message as loving or hateful?
I don't think it's either, but I think there's an underlying issue in John's message that is coming from the evangelical church that draws a great concern to me, that continue to isolate off this one particular issue when, one, there are few references to it in Scripture, and quite honestly, as a Christian, Christ says nothing about this issue. And so I think there's a real concern that I have that programs like Love in Action continue to allow the evangelical church to basically oppress or put aside a whole group of people and say that they don't have a place at the table of the kingdom of God. I think we have to begin to change that story and understand that Christ came not to condemn, but he came to redeem and to save the world.
And Leah, you're looking forward to many more years of life and living with your sexuality. What do you think that's going to look like? Do you picture yourself potentially one day married in a heterosexual relationship, or is there something else, a kind of monastic life in the world that you're describing for us?
Well, for now, I am really enjoying being single and the freedom that comes with being single. One day, maybe marriage? Yeah. I would not be at all opposed to that. But at the moment, I am loving life as a 22-year-old. You know, I'm very thrilled about the time that I get to spend by myself.
Leah, we wish you luck and happy self-realization on whatever path you choose. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Leah Dariel. We're joined now from East Hampton, New York, by Jack Drescher. He is chair of the American Psychiatric Association Committee on Gay, Lesbian, and Bisexual Issues. He's clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at the State University of New York Downstate Medical Center. Jack Drescher, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been listening. What do you make of this conversation, the debate that's going on around conversion therapy?
Well, it's a debate that's been going on, I think, for a long time. Perhaps Freud first tried to treat a homosexual woman patient, I think wrote a paper about it in 1920, and came to the conclusion that trying to change a homosexual into a heterosexual was as possible as trying to change a heterosexual into a homosexual. So he was kind of pessimistic about the whole thing back then. And the mainstream of, the mental health professions today really are not teaching people how to do conversion therapies. It's not taught in psychiatric training programs or most accredited psychology programs. I assume the same in social work. So this is really a kind of phenomenon that's occurring on the margins of the mental health mainstream. As we heard, the Reverend Smith's program, for example, had to change their website so that it conformed with state law because they're not really, a mental health clinic.
That is, so as not to describe it as therapy, but rather, I think, Reverend Smith, spiritual counseling, John Smith, is the phrase you use today.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, so from a religious perspective, I think this is a big religious argument that's going on within the religious all the religious communities in the United States and around the world. And as we've heard, religious groups are arguing with each other and within themselves about the correct interpretation of Scripture, and that's a religious argument. Where the mental health mainstream comes in is that we are always, of course, concerned about the kinds of activities that kind of confuse mental health activities with other activities. So when religious people call homosexuality an addiction, it sounds like a mental health kind of language, but it's not. Homosexuality is not considered an addiction. In fact, sexual addiction is not even considered a psychiatric diagnosis in the current diagnostic system. So there's this kind of overlap between what goes on in these spiritual counseling things that sort of sounds like mental health issues, but it has really nothing to do with scientific mental health issues.
We've got an interesting mix of medical language, yes, and common parlance here, but let me ask you in that regard, as a medical professional, a psychiatric professional, you know that for anyone coming into the sexuality can be traumatic. For homosexuals, it can be doubly difficult because often there are social issues, difficulties to deal with there. Is this kind of effort that you see on behalf of fundamentalist Christians to either convert to heterosexual or at least tamp down the homosexuality, do you see that as kindness or cruelty, if I can use those layperson's words with a professional?
Well, I would not impugn the motives of the people involved, in trying to help other people as they think best.
But in effect.
Well, sometimes, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. That is, it is possible, for example, to try to be helpful and do some harm. Some of the problems, looking from the medical psychiatric perspective into how the religious community is interpreting some of the data, is that they're making some assumptions that may not be borne out by, any research or data, but by faith. That is, they hope it would be true, but it may not be true. So we see, for example, I've treated patients, for example, who have been through these treatments and, have later come out as gay. And so so what I've seen is that patients go in and they're told that their motivation to change is the primary factor that will allow them to change.
Mm-hmm. And if they want it badly enough, they can change.
If they want it badly enough, if their faith is strong enough, that it is presented to them pretty much in that way, and that is considered the marker of success. When they're faltering and they're not succeeding, often the therapist will say things like, "Well, you're not trying hard enough," or "You don't believe hard enough." And these people do try hard, and they do believe, and they will do this for years. And sometimes they will see successive therapists. At least that's what I've seen in my practice. And so at the end, when the treatment doesn't work, when they have been unable to change, when they're unable to control their feelings, when they feel that they want to come out as gay, the first thing they usually do is they blame themselves for what happened, because that's what the treatment said. You are the motivating force.
Right, right. It's up to you.
So it's up to you. And so they wind up often feeling a lot of shame about the failure of the treatment. They don't blame the therapist. They don't blame God. They don't blame the treatment. They usually blame themselves. They often wind up feeling worse, and patients have reported feeling more depressed, more anxious. Patients have reported feeling more suicidal. In addition, while many people have gone through these treatments, with the encouragement of the therapist, they may have gotten married. They may have had children during the course of the treatment, and of course, at the end, the marriage may fall apart. When the husband or the wife comes out as gay after the treatment has failed, after many years, they've stayed in treatment to keep the marriage going, and and marriages fall apart, children, parents divorce. So that's what I see.
So lots of potential downside here, Brandon Tidwell. What about that? Was it hard for you to come back out of your experience here? Did you feel shame, guilt on the way back to your resolution?
I think Dr. Drescher hit the nail on the head. He's exactly right in that you are sort of taught that your faith is not deep enough. That's why you can't overcome what it is you're dealing with. When I began to ask for space theologically to explore the reconciliation between my identity and faith, I was told, "You don't have space here to do that. You can't be a part of this church or this ministry." And there was a lot of shame that somehow I had failed in my faith, that I did not love Jesus, quote-unquote, enough. and it ended up sending me into some very deep depression and things that I really had to deal with. And when I was able to finally work with some qualified therapists, some licensed therapists, and who still understood the depth of my faith and spirituality, I was able to come to a real place of reconciliation where today I would say that my faith is stronger than it's ever been. And my relationship with God and understanding of my identity is incredibly clear. And I just feel real compassion for people that continue to feel that their faith is not deep enough, that continue to be pushed underneath that guise of shame to keep them at bay, to no longer act out on those that homosexuality. I think it's just a very dangerous process, and I appreciate Dr. Drescher's comments in regards to that.
Reverend Smith, we want to get your response to this, but we've got to take a short break here. Brandon Tidwell, I know we have to let you go. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much.
Brandon Tidwell joined us from Dallas, Texas, 29 years old, a Methodist churchgoer there, and after his shot at being ex-gay, he's decided no, he's going to be Christian and gay. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Is America too open to homosexuality or not open enough? Is it right for a parent to send a teenage child to sexuality boot camp? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the controversy over so-called conversion therapy for gays. Fundamentalist Christians are pushing it. Many others oppose it. You can join us. What do you think? Can homosexuality be changed by counseling, by sitting with the Bible? Should it be changed? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Reverend John Smith, Executive Director of Love in Action, an evangelical organization that offers programs that it says helps its clients overcome their homosexuality. And we're joined from East Hampton, New York, by Jack Drescher, Chair of the American Psychiatric Association Committee on Gay, Lesbian, and Bisexual Issues. Reverend Smith, a lot laid out there before the break. Essentially, Jack Drescher and Brandon Tidwell, who once participated in your program, saying there's a downside here that you may saddle graduates, if that's the right word, with guilt and shame that leaves them worse off. Is there a risk of that? How do you think about it?
Well, I feel really grieved that that would be the outcome. That certainly would not be my desire. I think that homosexuality is a very, very complex issue, and it's often associated with many other factors besides just the sexuality. There's just many other facets to the underlying issues and the relationship issues that come out of it.
Such as
sometimes there are personality disorders, sometimes there are other factors that play into it that certainly, because we refer people out when they have those kinds of issues, we recognize some people come to us with factors that need professional care, and that's a reality of the type of people that we often see are struggling with these issues. I find it's also interesting that Dr. Drescher mentioned the difficulty with men or women who get married after they go through this type of counsel. And what I find, I've been with Love in Action for 18 years, mm-hmm. and every single marriage that has come after someone has come through our program, and I was just counting them up. I'm up to the count of 10, at least now, 10 marriages that have come through, all of whom are strong, viable, healthy marriages, and one marriage out of all the marriages I've seen has ended in divorce. And the complications around that were quite unique. And so what I actually find is that people are much healthier when they come through this program. They are healthier in communication, healthier in their own identities, and I think really even lives that we've known that have chosen to go back to homosexuality, there are factors in their life that I think are significantly better. And we're not the end of the road. You know, we help people while they're with us, and they may have other factors that they have to resolve after they leave. And that's something that they go on and do.
Let's open this conversation to our callers. John is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks.
Well, as a gay man growing up in the Bible Belt and also not believing in Christianity, which is interesting because when I listen to this, it really is a discussion about Christianity. And the Smith said that his program takes a rational approach, which first I would say that how can you possibly take a rational approach in Christianity when the fundamental tenet is that somebody came back from the dead? Very irrational.
You're saying it's about faith and religion, not necessarily, in your view, about rationality.
Absolutely not about rationality. If you want to make it about rationality, rationally, I mean, gay people are very successful. I mean, they're the most affluent minority, where we don't have the psychological problems that, I mean, there's not, I don't think, I don't have the numbers on it, but I don't think we're any more crazy than straight people are.
So do you feel stigmatized by what you're hearing from the, from the conversion therapy folks?
Yeah, it just seems like, I feel like, please, in this country, can we possibly get past, you know, everybody's kooky beliefs? And, you know, and start living, like, what is really happening in the world? Like, are people really, like, are all gay people just not able to, you know, function in society? We're compared to drug users. That's, you know, drug users, they can't function in society. And that's why we say that, you know, that's a problem.
So your assessment is, rationally considered, gays are doing just fine, thank you. Let's go with that.
Well, you know, and I've been following the whole Zach Taylor thing. And it's interesting because I saw the CBN broadcast of his father, which I thought was very interesting that he went on CBN to discuss this all.
It's a Christian network?
Right, the Christian network.
Mm-hmm.
That guy is as Nelly as they come. That's a closet case right there. I mean, I can pick him out.
John, we got the perspective, and thanks for calling. Let's get another call here, if we may. Kevin is calling from Boston. Hi, Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi. I was just listening when you first started introducing the show,
mm-hmm.
and you were talking about the Reverend was talking about Zach, and then he was talking about his program. He was talking about the options that are given. You know that,
yes.
that his program is offering options, and to me it sounded like Zach didn't get any options. Zach was forced to go into this program. He wasn't asked if he wanted to go into this program. He didn't make the decision on his own to go into this program. He was forced to go into this program. That's not an option as far as I'm concerned.
What do you think about that for a 16-year-old? Is it right for parents to take that kind of active intervening step or wrong?
I think you take those actions, you know, with your children. I've got kids, and they're not 16 yet, and I, you know, eventually will be faced with decisions to be made. But, you know, I'm always a little suspicious of any program that's got religion behind it. It's because, you know, there it's got its own set of rules that don't necessarily mean they're right or they're wrong.
But lots of people send their children to religious schools. Lots of people send their kids, compel their children to go to military schools. Is this different, Kevin?
I think it is when you're talking. Yeah, I think it is. I just think that people are imposing on their children their beliefs. And that's what everybody does. It's just that, you know, this kid and every other kid that goes through this sort of, you know, and as far as I'm concerned, I think people are sort of born into, or they're sort of chemically composed to be heterosexual, homosexual.
Kevin, we've got it. I want to get back to our guests, but thanks for your call. Reverend Schmidt, what percentage of those who come through your gates come compelled by their parents? They are young people generally.
A very high percentage. We believe very strongly that a parent has not only the right but the responsibility to intervene on his child's behalf when they deem that's necessary. And you can read even in Zach's blog that Zach had some very strong feelings towards his parents that were quite counterproductive, and his parents knew that he needed to get some help. And so because of their Christian convictions, their Christian concerns, they felt like our program was a good fit for their son and for their circumstances.
Jack Drescher, coming to terms with sexuality, never easy. This is one family's response to it. What would you have said to this, to Zach's family, if you could have sat with them? I realize you don't know all the details, but
sure. I don't. Well, you know, it wouldn't be appropriate for me to comment on a case that I've not personally examined. But you know, in general, I mean, I think my concern for parents in general who are considering sending their children to a program like this is that they're not getting all the information. They are families, when they find out that a child might be having homosexual feelings or acting on the homosexual feelings, are often, and particularly families that are religious, are going to be quite upset. They're going to be quite desperate. They're going to be looking for help. And they're going to be looking for help from people who are, in some regards, are going to provide them with a perspective that they believe in. I have no question about the belief involved in this system. But sometimes belief, you know, overshadows some of the facts. And some of the facts are that, one is that we really don't know what causes homosexuality. And so many of the conversion therapies that I've read about and studied and heard about from my patients, you know, they all have a theory about teaching the patient why they're homosexual. Nobody knows what causes homosexuality or heterosexuality for that matter. So that's one problem. The second problem is really that because parents are not told about the cases that might be harmed, you know, they run the risk of harming their own child. And that can happen sometimes, certainly. And they also run the risk, if the child does eventually in the future decide to come out as gay and accept their homosexuality, they run a good risk of harming their relationship with the child in the future.
Do you see no upside here?
Well, yes, I can see an upside. I think that it's not such a terrible thing, you know, to teach kids restraint and self-control. If a child is having difficulties that move beyond sexual behavior, drug, and truly destructive behaviors, then of course, you know, everybody would want to intervene in the treatment of such a child. And I don't think there's anything wrong with teaching kids, you know, restraint, you know. But
with that, I'm afraid we're out of time. Jack Drescher, chair of the American Psychiatric Association Committee on Gay, Lesbian, and Bisexual Issues, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Reverend John Smith, Executive Director at Love in Action, thanks for laying out your picture for us tonight. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
In a moment, Bill Frist throws his support behind embryonic stem cell research. This is On Point. In a big surprise in Washington today, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist broke with the White House on the sensitive issue of embryonic stem cell research. The Bush administration has limited federal funding to research on a fixed number of stem cell lines that existed in 2001. Frist told the Senate this morning that it's time for a change.
I believe the president's policy should be modified. We should expand federal funding and the accompanying NIH oversight and current guidelines governing stem cell research.
Many abortion opponents oppose the use of embryonic stem cells. Senator Frist, who is a physician and identifies himself as pro-life, now disagrees. Cece Conley is covering the story for The Washington Post. I asked her what made the senator change his mind.
Well, Tom, I had a chance to speak briefly with the majority leader after he gave his speech on the Senate floor today. And what he said to me was that while he has been hearing for quite some time that the number of these embryonic stem cell lines under the Bush policy are far fewer than expected. When the president made his announcement, they said it could be 78 of these lines for research. It's now only about 22. But Senator Frist said that it's only been in the last month that he has learned from scientists that those 22 lines have some problems with them. It gets fairly technical, Tom, but in essence, the way that Senator Frist kind of explains it is if you were to photocopy a document and then photocopy it again and again, it gets a little weaker each time in the copying, each time in the replication. So he was expressing some concerns that those 22 lines just won't suffice.
So Bill Frist, looking all the way back to the tight restrictions President Bush put on federal funding for stem cell lines, a small number of lines, in 2001 and saying in 2005, we've got to do what, Cece?
Well, it's interesting. Senator Frist has said several things over the course of 4 years. 4 years ago, before the president came out with his policy, Senator Frist was advocating a very broad, ambitious research policy. Then when President Bush announced his somewhat confining research policy in August of 2001, Senator Frist said, okay, we'll give that a try. I'll go along and support the president. And he's essentially been doing that up until today. Today he came out and said, you know what, I've looked at this some more. I've changed my mind. the president's policy now is insufficient. I want to support legislation that will open up the door for much more federally funded research on many more of those stem cell lines.
And what kinds of diseases was he suggesting today stem cell research might address?
What you hear not only from Senator Frist, who, as I'm sure you're aware, is a physician, so carries a lot of authority on these subjects, but also scientists in the field, is that it appears embryonic stem cells could take us to some treatments and or cures for things such as juvenile diabetes, Parkinson's disease, spinal cord injury, and a number of different types of cancers. And the short explanation for why that is that these embryonic stem cells appear to be quite amazing little buggers. They are able to morph into essentially any cell or tissue in your own body, giving humans the prospect someday of being able to replicate their own cells or tissue and use that own their own materials to essentially treat themselves.
Bill Frist saying today along that line that these cells have a, quoting him, remarkable capacity to become any kind of tissue. And he went on to name Parkinson's and Lou Gehrig's disease. As you say, he's a doctor. He said so, saying today, I'm a physician. My profession is healing. What kind of sway do you think Bill Frist's conversion here is likely to have on fellow senators?
His colleagues have always looked to him for guidance, some would say cover, on some matters of science and health, because he does understand these issues, and he's awfully good at explaining these complicated subjects to the average layperson. There was already talk up in Congress today, in the immediate aftermath of his speech, about a number of senators and perhaps even some House members who now could change their position after hearing this fairly detailed address by the Senate Majority Leader.
There is a bill in the House passed there in May that would provide funding for cells that come from fertility clinics where they would have been destroyed otherwise. Is that what Senator Frist is now lining up to support?
Yes. He said explicitly to me and fairly clearly in his Senate speech that he does indeed support that bill that passed the House. It is yet to be determined when exactly that vote could be in the Senate. People are expecting it sometime in September.
President Bush has already said that he would veto the bill that passed the House. Is there any possibility of a sufficient majority on Capitol Hill to run past a presidential veto on stem cell?
The feeling today on Capitol Hill is that the Senate probably has a better chance of mustering a veto-proof majority. That would take 67 of the 100 votes in the Senate. I don't think that anyone is saying they are there yet, but that it is certainly within sight. In the House, when they had that vote in May, the margin was 50 votes short of being veto-proof. That still appears to be a pretty wide gap, although you can imagine with a lot of the excitement on the Hill this morning around Senator Frist's speech, some of those folks are now talking optimistically about doing that.
Former First Lady Nancy Reagan, who of course has been a big advocate of stem cell research, embryonic stem cell research, hailing Frist's change of mind today. Arlen Specter, a fellow Republican in the Senate who's battling cancer, saying this is a speech that will be heard around the world. Whether it can muster votes beyond what can be vetoed, we'll have to wait and see. But Cece Conley, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. My pleasure.
Cece Conley is national reporter at the Washington Post. She spoke with me from Washington. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Michael Garth, Matt Lieber, Mary Moore, Persephone Meal, and Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.